Welcome to Alaska Edition, a weekly public affairs program produced by Alaska Public Media in the studios of KAKM.
Hello and welcome to Alaska Edition. I'm your host, Zachariah Hughes. Today on the show, we are talking about LNG, liquefied natural gas. Legislators held a special session to discuss a proposed gas pipeline capable of bringing massive quantities of natural gas from the North Slope all the way to market in Alaska and abroad. The prospect has been has the potential to change how Alaska uses natural resources to pay for government, but that, if it even happens, is still years away. To discuss what's happening right now, I'm lucky to be joined by three hardworking journalists that all cover LNG in one way or another. Rachel Wolholtz is the Alaska Public Radio Network's energy reporter. Alex DeMarbin covers rural affairs and energy for the Alaska Dispatch News. And Austin Baird is a reporter for KTUU here in Anchorage. But Austin, you just got back from Juneau. And so tell me about the special session. It's the third this year, and why did it have to happen now?
Sure. So by the end of the year, the state had to decide if they wanted to take an option that was laid out in Senate Bill 138 that was passed a year ago, 2014, when Sean Parnell was still governor. The core of the issue was whether or not to pay TransCanada, a pipeline company, about $70 million, if I'm remembering right off the top of my head, to exit the Alaska LNG project so the state could become a 25% owner alongside BP, Conoco, and Exxon. That was kind of the core of it. Took a couple weeks for them to reach a decision, and in the end, that's, of course, what they went with.
So we'll get more to some of the particulars and the political level of the pipeline, but before that, Alex, just so we're all on the same page about this, what is the gas pipeline, and how long has it been an idea in the state?
Well, it's a huge effort to tap the North Slope gas reserves that have, the effort's been around for more than four decades. There's been numerous projects. In fact, there was one called the Alaska Natural Gas Transportation System in 83. I found a book on it. Already by that time, $1 billion had been spent, and this is 1983. So I thought the acronym should have been ANGST for angst. There's been a lot of acronyms along the years. They've all failed for various reasons. It's difficult to get the gas out of the ground and to market because of the huge facilities involved. So from the North Slope all the way to Tidewater, and then what do you do with it after that, or through Canada?
Well, the route, just a huge issue. The route from the North Slope down to its terminus. Rachel, I want to ask you a little bit about that, but before I do, I want to play a short video that our video team made. It's about just LNG in general to make sure we're all on the same page about what we're talking about.
State lawmakers have one hot mess on their hands right now, the Alaska LNG project. It's a giant pipeline the state hopes to build, along with three or four other industry partners, to bring liquefied natural gas, that's LNG, from the North Slope to market. Let's look at some of the details. First off, this is a big and spendy endeavor. $45 to $65 billion. By comparison, that's roughly the GDP of Bulgaria. And that figure accounts for three big things. One, a gas treatment plant. Two, the pipeline itself. And three, a giant liquefaction plant in Nikiski. The gas treatment plant on the North Slope will strip out impurities like carbon dioxide. From there, the gas would go into an 800-mile underground pipeline built right alongside Alaska's other trusty pipeline, Old Taps. But instead of going to Valdez, this pipeline would head to Cook Inlet, where it'll end at a brand spanking new liquefaction facility in Nikiski. This is where the magic happens, and it's really expensive magic. Roughly half the cost of the LNG project's $45 to $65 billion price tag is the liquefaction plant. Liquefaction is a fancy word for to make liquid. And that's exactly what happens to the gas. Long story short, when the gas is chilled and becomes liquid, it becomes 600 times smaller, which is really convenient for shipping. But natural gas has to get really cold to liquefy, like negative 260 degrees Fahrenheit. That's about how cold it is on Saturn. Brr. Fun fact here, if you pour cold LNG into a glass, it would look just like a glass of water. But don't spill it, and don't confuse the two before you drink. So we have a bunch of liquid gas that has to stay really cold. It would get held in storage tanks in Nikiski until ships arrive to courier it away. Those ships are essentially floating thermoses, specially designed to transport LNG to buyers in Asia. Once the gas arrives in Asia, it's warmed back up and turned into regular old natural gas, like what your heater runs on. So that's the how of Alaska LNG. The big question is, Will it ever happen? That all depends on the market. For one, are there enough buyers who want LNG in Asia? And two, will they commit to buy it from Alaska? Right now, the project is still in its early planning and design stages. If all goes according to plan, the state and its partners would make the decision on whether or not to break ground in 2018. And the first Alaska gas would hopefully ship by 2024.
So, Rachel, I want to just ask you about the three different parts of that project in terms of the infrastructure and the equipment. How big are they as an overall project, and then how hard is it to pay for both the building and then maintenance on those?
Yeah, it's huge. I mean, so I talked to the project's technical manager at the project, and she said sort of each part is sort of a mega project in its own right. So the gas treatment plant would be the largest in the Arctic, I think. The pipeline would be, you know, an 800-mile pipeline, just like TAPS. And then the liquefaction facility would be just giant and, you know, as the video said, half the cost of this project. And so she said altogether they're calling it a giga project. That's sort of the term within the project itself. So big. It's really big.
So big it needs a new term.
Right, exactly.
Alex, could you just walk me through some of the state's overall profile when it comes to LNG? Because we hear about Cook Inlet and the gas fields there, the Muni in Anchorage right now is making a bid for some of that. There's the Interior Energy Project, and then very recently you've written about the approval process for letting LNG be imported from Canada. So what's the state's profile like?
What do you mean? What are all the projects that the state's working on?
Yeah, the meaningful ones. I mean, we hear about this one, but what else is there kind of out there?
Primarily when it comes to LNG, I mean, it'd be the big $55 billion Alaska LNG project. And then some kind of project to get LNG to the interior, which I think it's the Alaska Energy Authority that's currently working on that and trying to get a private arrangement. And there are different offers on the table from five different companies to try to bring LNG to the interior to help lower costs there. So I think those are the two primary ones.
Yeah, and you sort of don't want to get confused. There's this giant gas line that the state's trying to build, and one of the goals there is to bring some of that gas to Alaskans and to bring down the cost of energy. So there would be sort of five offtakes along the line that hopefully would deliver some of that gas. But, you know, this isn't going to be up and running, best case scenario, until mid-2020. So there's these other ideas floating around for getting either Cook Inlet gas to Fairbanks or getting gas maybe from British Columbia to rural Alaska, and those are sort of separate sort of more shorter term projects.
So there's a short term, and then overarching all of that is the potential to build an entirely new apparatus for extraction and delivery. I hope I'm not botching that too badly.
And an interesting thing is that Crowley, for example, is now looking at bringing LNG in from Canada. And then there's also a company that's looking at doing that in Southeast, planning to do that as well. In fact, Crowley and this other company have just won permits to import from Canada. So.
And
ironic thing there, but I don't. In the case of Crowley, at least the state's not involved at this point that I'm aware of.
I want to come back to that about the appetite in state and then markets abroad for LNG produced in Alaska. But before that, I want to just talk about one of the other major challenges, which is the political one. And Austin, could you explain to me the votes were overwhelmingly for the governor's proposal on this, but what were legislators actually voting on?
So what they were voting on was very simply just the question of whether or not to buy TransCanada's stake in the Alaska LNG project. So it's really, in the scheme of things, if you were looking at a pie chart of, you know, $60 or so million, in the scheme of $65 billion, you'd barely be able to even see a line. That's how much they were actually voting on. And they also approved some additional staff. They approved a few new positions within various departments that will be key for the Alaska LNG project. And they also that was really just about it. And as you said, overwhelmingly in favor. Three Republicans from the Mattsu Valley voted against. Everyone else saw this as a kind of a no-brainer because the state had to pay back that money sooner or later. So it was going to be paid eventually. And.
Yeah, and just to pick up on what Austin was saying, I think for a lot of lawmakers, they saw it really as not having much of a choice. That TransCanada, the way that it worked, TransCanada held half of the state's share of this project. So it's a four-way partnership with ExxonMobil, BP, and ConocoPhillips. And then there was the state and TransCanada kind of sharing a quarter. And the way it worked was the state was sort of on the hook for TransCanada's costs no matter what. So people sort of saw it as pay now or pay later, and there was a sense that paying now would be cheaper and the state would get a larger seat at the table, sort of controlling that full 25% share of this project. So I think a lot of lawmakers got to the point where they just felt like it's obvious.
And if it did go past December 31st, then the state would also owe interest, 7% interest. So the cost would have gone up for every day beyond December 31st of this year that the state did not buy TransCanada's share. So
this was not an endorsement of the project overall. This was not voting to sink a shovel into the ground.
Well, I think it was an endorsement. Like, I think a lot of lawmakers saw this as a way to express the state's support for the project. So even lawmakers that expressed a lot of reservations about how the Walker administration is handling the gas line, they voted for it. I mean, the House voted 39-0. That's overwhelming in a House that has been at various times at loggerheads with the administration. So I think they saw it as an endorsement of, we want a gas line. But in terms of, do we want to spend that money yet? That decision, nobody has to make that decision yet. That's, you know, right now this is $160 million to get us through this first phase. Then there's another decision point on the next phase, which would be sort of a $600 million investment for the state. And then there's another decision point before the state lays out the big money, which would be $14 to $16 billion to actually construct the project.
And without jumping too far ahead, I guess the next big true vote of confidence is December 4th. And that's when the four partners, the Alaska Gasline Development Corporation and the three private companies that are involved, will all have to affirmatively vote yes to continue on with the project. And the AKLNG project manager from Exxon told me that they're constantly testing the viability of this project. And who knows? Who knows if it will carry on? Nobody knows. It's a private vote. The results will be known. If the project goes on, everyone voted yes. If the project does not go on, somebody voted no, but we won't know who.
You're breaking my heart. I was going to ask you to look into the crystal ball I keep down here and just tell me whether or not it was going to happen and when. But I want to switch just from that. We'll return to that. But Alex, I want to ask you, have you seen the project get to this phase before? Are we in kind of new territory on this?
Well, I think we are in new territory in the sense that, for one thing, you have all the people with the rights to the gas at the table. And then, you know, there's a real process going on before FERC right now. It is the early filing, pre-filing process. There's a long way to go. The next big decision won't really come now until 2017, and that's already delayed. It looks like it's already delayed up to a year at this point. So, we have quite a long way to go. We'll see if it actually happens or not. It wouldn't begin producing gas for another decade. So people seem to get upset that it's not moving more quickly. The final end date may not have changed much, but again, it's still a decade away. So. Mm.
And Austin, what is the relationship like down in Juneau between the governor's administration and legislators?
Oh, you know, overall, I would say on this issue, there's more agreement than on many other issues. And ask anyone, everybody will say, we want a pipeline. There certainly were some moments of back and forth. And I think the way I heard this session described and the reason that it lasted about 2 weeks for a fairly, what many legislators saw as an obvious decision, is they were trying to have kind of an educational opportunity for members of the finance committees who may not have had an in-depth look at the gas line issues, but they're going to have to really know it moving ahead between now and 2017 when the big investments start being made. But overall, there certainly were some Republicans who were upset about the governor's approach to confidentiality agreements and some things like that. The governor has not allowed confidentiality agreements, but that's overall, this is more of a unifying theme, understandably, in Alaska politics.
Yeah, and I'd say, I mean, one of the reasons it lasted 2 weeks was so that lawmakers could kind of rake the administration over the coals a little bit. I mean, I think there's for sure, everyone's aligned, everyone wants a gas line, but there are for sure some disagreements about how the administration's handling it. Lawmakers spend a whole lot of time being like, who's in charge, who's leading the state's gas team? And eventually the governor said, I am, the governor is, but who is immediately below him is still sort of in flux.
And I want to just ask after that, there was some, I feel like that was sort of one of the flashpoints from the session of the big to-do over the governor's organizational chart that had 100 different boxes.
The word org chart came up really more often than you would think is possible.
Chart, yeah. There were three no votes in the Senate, and I think at that point, I think it's sort of taken as conventional wisdom that those were symbolic, but you were there. What was that about?
Yeah, I mean, I don't think, so that was, I think, Mike Dunleavy, Charlie Huggins, and Bill Stoltz voted no in the Senate. And I don't think any of them were against, I mean, they're certainly not against the gas line. And I didn't get the sense that they were against TransCanada either, or the TransCanada buyout. You can correct me if I'm wrong. But they, I mean, literally Dunleavy stood up and said, I want to send a message to the governor to get his act together on this subject. And that's what it was about.
Senator Stoltz said the same thing. I didn't hear directly from Senator Huggins afterwards or push with any follow-up questions. But I don't think anyone in the entire legislature truly opposed the purchase on economic grounds or anything else.
That's sort of nudging us towards some of the transparency issues that you started bringing up, Austin. And before we get there, I want to pull up a quote. And this is from the Attorney General Craig Richards. He said, and I'm pulling this from one of your stories, Rachel, it is in the producer's interest not to have more transparency and sunshine in the process, because the more information that they control and the more information that they can limit being put out there to the Alaska people gives them more control in the process. And I want to ask you, Austin, just a little bit about the balancing act between transparent government on the one hand and then private companies and the need to maintain a sort of competitive edge in such an expansive project like this.
So there are absolutely legitimate economic concerns that a company would have if they have a product that is unique and plays some small role in this giga project that their entire business is built around. Oil and energy companies have a lot of subcontractors. They have a lot of people who bring services to them that they don't actually own. And that's the sort of thing where, say, it's some kind of pumping mechanism or something that legitimately that company could say, well, we're not going to provide information about what we're doing because we don't want another company to take it. That's the kind of agreement that is pretty obvious. People can, across the board, legislature, governor can agree on. Where it's more ambiguous is when it comes to financial information, when it comes to why is some of the information required to be kept confidential? And one question that came up a few times is, I guess the most interesting question unanswered for me is, how can companies that work with a ton of contractors and subcontractors require everyone to explain why information should be confidential, and how long would it take to go through that process? And then on the counterpoint to it is the governor sees this as a step towards transparency and a way of improving the Alaska Gas Line Development Corporation's understanding of what's going on, the state interest.
Yeah, and the backstory here is that the governor campaigned on a promise of bringing more transparency to the whole gas line issue, and so he came in and he has insisted that sort of top officials not sign confidentiality agreements, which was one issue. And then another issue is that to sort of comply with that pledge from the governor, the Alaska Gas Line Development Corporation, which is sort of heading up parts of the state's involvement in the project, has issued a set of draft regulations to say, okay, this is what we will and will not allow to be confidential and secret in our negotiations with our partners, which is big oil companies, BP, Exxon, Conoco, and all of their subcontractors. And those regulations came out earlier this fall, and the response from those partners was dead on arrival. This isn't going to work. This will stop the project in its tracks. And so that came up in the legislature where lawmakers were essentially saying, you're asking, we need to act like a business, we need to sign these confidentiality agreements, sort of asking for less information from the administration on this particular point.
That's so interesting. And then, Alex, that gets to mm-hmm. something that you've written about recently, which is salaries for some of the people that are working here and consultants. You just recently had a piece on a very well-compensated individual, and I wonder if you could give me the background and some of the details on that.
Yeah, so Rigdon Boykin, he called himself a friend of the governor's. He has worked with the governor before on a previously municipal-led pipeline project that was one of the many that failed. Anyway, Rigdon Boykin from South Carolina, he's making $120,000 a month, although now he's the governor has requested that he be repurposed in some way. I'm wondering if he's going to be slid out the door.
What does that mean? Is he still getting paid, or is he off?
He's still getting paid for now. I think the contract ends at the end of the year, so it's $120,000 a month still.
A month, not a year. A month.
A month, yeah. So I don't know what his new role will be, or if he'll have a new role. We'll see. It sounds like they're going to let the contract run out, and then we'll figure it out.
Is that normal for? I feel like if I'm hearing about private industry, I'm a little bit more accustomed to hearing about salaries that are, pushing upwards of hundreds of thousands of dollars a year. But in, for a consultant on a project like this, is it normal?
It's hard to say. I mean, some of our oil and gas consultants in the past have received close to that or maybe a little bit more in some cases on a month-to-month basis. So it just depends. It's certainly expensive. We do want to have good people at the table. You know, the legislature wonders if he's the right person at the table.
It does kind of get to the question of what are people doing for that amount of money? And that's one question just on a basic level a lot of people had that I heard again and again from our viewers and saw online is, so what do we pay TransCanada for? What are we paying Rigdon Boykin for? And there are big definite answers to that, which is to say we pay TransCanada for technical information and things like that. But that's still at the same time politically a tough sell, and it's tough, I think, understandably for people to fully grasp why are we paying these people this much money and we still don't have a pipeline.
Well, there's a quote that I want to put up on the board really quickly from in the opinion pages of the Arctic Sounder. Carrie Restino wrote it, and it says, there are times in Alaska's history when big salaries were commonplace and money flowed as freely as the tides. Those days are gone. Now we are just another place in America with a high cost of living and and challenging weather. Alaska, especially our top officials, needs to adjust its thinking accordingly, end quote. Austin, you have written about transparency. I want to hear a little bit about that. And then just where the salaries issue compares for you in terms of how the pipeline project is being advanced and decided at the political level.
Sure. So I recently did a project for the Center for Public Integrity. It was part of a national investigation. I did the state chapter, and maybe surprisingly for some who followed the VECO scandal and things like that, back in 2006, Alaska overall came out looking relatively strong in terms of ethics and openness in government. And that goes back to various laws. Oversight of lobbying here. Many states don't have registration requirements that are too strong. They don't have training requirements, things like that. There's also political financing rules and things like that that bump Alaska up. One area that Alaska performs extremely poorly, access to information, public records. Alaska has inconsistent laws that rank among the worst in the nation, failing grade according to that investigation. And I guess the answer to your second question, so, you know, I guess at least we know what the salary for this individual is, for Rigdon Boykin, but the question of balancing confidentiality and everything else, and given that there's not like a single office that deals with public records and things like that in the state, how much will we know? And there's no good answer to that. Probably not as much as we would like. That's maybe the short answer.
Just as we're getting closer to the end, I want to just quickly touch on, did I have it right that the Center for Public Integrity found Alaska to have the worst kind of overall dealings? I mean, I think I remember seeing the top of the heap when it came to failures of accountability and transparency.
So So the way, Alaska came out looking comparatively strong overall. But when it was, so if you're looking at like the judicial system, the executive system, oversight of those and political financing laws and things like that, because we have relatively low campaign contribution limits, the state overall looked actually relatively strong, still has a lot of areas to work on, but and none more so than public records, very poor statutes for public records.
Just, I'm sorry that we're getting to the end, and I do want to ask the three of you, because you're sort of experts on this topic, but taking a step back, does it make sense for Alaska to be linking its future with another hydrocarbon, with climate change kind of really popping up as a major issue for a lot of the communities and a lot of the politics in the state? Is this sensible to make an existential connection with what's basically the slightly cleaner fossil fuel?
I think it's a good idea for us to pursue LNG. It's called the fuel of the future by a lot of people, and so I think demand is going to grow. It's cleaner, and so I think that we should do it, and we kind of have to do it. But you can also wonder, we've given away a lot of money for credits that have never produced oil. I'm not saying they're all bad, but some of the money that we're spending, including on the gas line, could be better used for renewable energy projects throughout the state. There's a lot of opportunity there. So.
Yeah, I mean, I don't think that many people in state government see an option for Alaska that's not resource development. And there, you know, there's a funny LNG connection, which is that some folks think that the LNG market internationally is going to grow as sort of economies in Asia move off of coal. So you could say it's helping with sort of emissions internationally there. But I mean, the downside of being linked to hydrocarbons is that LNG is just as volatile a market as oil, which means that your budget is linked to the price of a commodity that we don't control.
My short answer, anything the state does is a gamble. Depending how much this costs, it's probably a good gamble, because the outlook, even though the Asian market for LNG is depressed and much lower than it has been at the peak a few years ago, 10 years from now, the conventional wisdom is it'll rebound and be a good investment. And decades out, who knows?
Great. Well, unfortunately, that is all the time that we have for this edition of Alaska Edition. Thank you to my guests, and thank you at home for joining us here at the KAKM studios. I'm Zachariah Hughes.
If you have questions or comments about the program, you can email Alaska Edition at alaskapublic.org or write us at 3877 University Drive, Anchorage, Alaska, 99508. Alaska Edition is a production of KAKM. The opinions expressed are those of the hosts and guests and do not necessarily represent those of KSKA, KAKM, the licensee, or their underwriters.